together. And were he to really explain where I got everything, every book would be five times longer with footnotes, so I can see why he didn't do that. But this book, I think, is like him really letting himself off the leash, though, and getting pretty technical. But even still, you know, after a long list of technical terms and dharmas and stuff, he reminds us that it all comes back to, like, looking at a flower with full attention. What else do you need, you know? So anyway, I had periods of resistance to Tenahan, you know, so mushy and nice, but he's got some depth in there, that's for sure. So you could read along in the book or in your handout. Let's just go through the verses, the first dozen or so, about the Alaya Vijñana. Let's get our little diagram up here. And we may, as we go, add more arrows, because, of course, it's always more complicated. And I've got a few comments about some of them, but maybe you have comments or thoughts, or maybe you noticed some things in the book if you got that far. And the great thing about not having gotten that far in the book is then we can still have it all, you know, still to go. It's good. Okay, part one, the store consciousness.
Is it possible to turn the light up?
Sure, I don't mind, yeah.
Thank you.
My copy has a built-in light.
Thanks.
Part one, the store consciousness. Verse one. Mind is a field in which every kind of seed is sown. This mind field can also be called all the seeds. So, the Alaya Vijñana. Pretty straightforward. Verse two. In us are infinite varieties of seeds. Seeds of samsara, nirvana, delusion, and enlightenment. Seeds of suffering and happiness. Seeds of perceptions, names, and words. Those last two are kind of a technical thing about names and words, and it has to do with recognizing that our conceptual apparatus, you know, defines things and categorizes things, and that's part of all this too, you know, so not to think. So in this system, intellectualization is not just a sort of after process. There's a built-in tendency that we have to put names and words to things. And it'll say a lot more about perception later. Perception is a very big deal in this system that we haven't even really touched on yet. How do we perceive? What do we perceive? And so on. Any thoughts or questions about verse 1 or 2? So we got this minefield full of seeds. So jump in anytime.
Do you think there's any sort of subtle hint in here that minefield is a minefield?
Minefield. Sure can be, huh?
I almost just read it that way.
Which is, in fact, another seed, you know, right? The way we read something. So that's the thing. So this gets down to just the minutest experience. Everything, in this system, everything that happens involves the ripening of a seed. So it's not just like big events. It's moment to moment. As you read, it's seeds that are germinating that enable you to interpret or misinterpret or reinterpret or whatever, yeah. Because people read, you know, and the reason why we know that's true is because different people read things differently, right? So the idea of this is that objectivity is very suspect. Everything is subjective. Yeah, everything is subjective. Okay, verse 3. Seeds that manifest as body and mind, as realms of being, stages, and worlds, are all stored in our consciousness. That is why it's called store. This next one is where it gets interesting. Some seeds are innate, handed down by our ancestors. Some were sown while we were still in the womb. Others were sown when we were children. So we're moving beyond the idea of just me. Like, this isn't just a different version of me. It's bigger than me. And we can receive seeds from our parents, from before our parents, from, I don't even know how. At one point I was visualizing like this underground farm has all these sort of caverns and caves that connects to everyone else's underground farms. Maybe it's like that, but of course it's not exactly a thing, right? But this fits, right, you know, the kind of collective unconscious, you know, kind of theories of psychology, you know, that Who knows how we get all these influences? We don't really know. Verse 5, whether transmitted by family, friends, society, or education, all of our seeds are by nature both individual and collective. And his chapter on that is kind of interesting. I won't spend too long on it, but he gets into his term interbeing, you know, that everything is sort of not just itself, also has elements of everything else, but isn't exactly everything else. The things inter-exist, inter-are. And so this idea of individual and collective has that quality that I think in there somewhere he uses the example of, or maybe I thought of this, the example of how young black men are disproportionately, you know, higher in prison, our prisons, you know, that's a collective and an individual emergence, you know, that, you know, those young men, many of them did stuff, you know, so it's individual, some of their individual seeds, individual karma was happening, but it's also collective. We collectively created situations and biases and so on where, you know, they're more likely to do those things, more likely to be punished, more likely to be blah, 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 blah. So I think this is a great kind of compassion verse, you know. It's a root of compassion to recognize that we have individual and collective responsibility for, well, everything. Yeah, everything. And then when we find ourselves locking it down on one side or the other, probably there's going to be a lot of suffering. And that makes me think of, I was doing a presentation, was Friday really yesterday? Mm-hmm. Well, yesterday. And when I do big presentations in Seattle, there's often one person who's sort of like a sort of crusty activist, you know, who's upset about something. And so this, in this case, and, you know, perfectly reasonable issues, but there's a kind of intensity where, like, she couldn't kind of see both sides of this. In this case, it was a pretty big room, and I was trying to figure out the best way for everybody to be able to hear, and there was a sound system in there, but the sound system sounded terrible. So I was like, okay, well, how's the sound without the sound system? And I put on the sound system, it sounded like a bad AM radio or something like that, and I'm like, oh, maybe not the sound system. And this woman got very upset. She said, these presents, and she kind of directed it at me, but of course it had nothing to do with me exactly, or did it, you know? She piped up and said, these presentations should be much more accessible. And she was angry, you know? And here I was just trying to get the sound right, you know? And so I don't know how this exactly fits, but it was striking. And so I tried to kind of take that in and said, well, you know, I hear what you're saying, and I'm sorry, let's do our best, you know? And there's a chair up in front if you want to move up, which kind of annoyed her, you know? She wanted to be in the back and have it be accessible to her and accessible to everybody. So it's like she had an individual motivation and a collective motivation, and was kind of, you know, creating this negative energy in the middle of the presentation about it. But then I went to talk to her in the break, and we had a lovely conversation, and I think she felt like a little more heard and listened to, and then after that she left. So interesting, you know, it's like, here's somebody with some passion around accessibility, beautiful, but somehow her expression of that, you know, I doubt anybody really, you know, people, it's hard for people to listen to somebody who's kind of has that sort of aggressive, angry kind of energy. But she's right, you know, they should have a better sound system in there. You know what I mean? So, I mean, that's just a kind of funny example, but it seems like we run into this all the time, where we're a little too much on the individual side, a little too much on the collective side, you know, of whatever the sort of karmic situation is. What would have your been experiences about this kind of thing? Like, is it me? Is it them? Is it us? You know? Is it me and us? Who's responsible?
I've always kind of resisted the idea that, yeah, something that happens, a black man gets shot in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
I've always kind of resisted this collective responsibility, mm-hmm. because I go, wait a minute, I don't own a gun. I did not do that.
Right. Right. So you don't have individual responsibility, but yeah, do we somehow have collective responsibility? What other thoughts about that? It's a subtle thing, you know. Yeah, it's not an easy thing. Chris?
I've been struggling and engaging a lot over the last maybe 4, 5, 6 months
mm-hmm.
with the term white privilege.
Right, yeah.
Because it falls, like you, I feel in a way, you know, I didn't cause the problem, I didn't, but at the same time, I'm approaching more the point that I am receiving a lot of privilege that's handed to me,
mm-hmm.
based on the fact that
where you're born and so
my
on.
Skin is white, that I received a good education, and I was not, frankly, I didn't even know that term existed, and I was definitely not willing to take responsibility for it. And in fact, I still struggle with some aspects of it, but just like white privilege, there's male privilege.
Mm-hmm.
And looks like you're the only privilege from here. But it's just...
Whoa. Yeah.
People inhabit it,
yeah.
without being aware of it.
Without
like,
seeing it, yeah.
Right.
And nobody please kill me, but Donald Trump is a perfect example.
Mm.
He ushers people around, he speaks about people,
mm-hmm.
from a total position of privilege. And so I've been studying him to make myself more aware of my...
Mm.
I don't know exactly what word to use, you know, my part in it. And I'm really aware of it because for 12 years I was married to a man who was Mexican Filipino. And it was so long ago that there was backlash from society about that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm aware of it, but I was never seeing myself as a the owner of the privilege.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's some really good books about it too.
Yeah, no, it's a very strange thing. And then the other kind of extra wrinkle that this system adds is reminding us that there's a lot going on in all of us individually and collectively that we're not even consciously aware of too, right? So remember, we're only aware of what our mind consciousness, the sixth consciousness, can really think about or notice. So, you know, there are various things planted down here for all of us, and yeah, so part of the work of this is to be curious, based on what emerges here, what might be down there. But let's go on. We'll see if maybe Tay will help us a little more later. Yeah.
One phrase. The Harvard University has a bias recognition website.
Oh yeah, I was trying to find that.
And
day.
It is really interesting if you do the exercises that directly speak to the subconscious.
It's called the implicit bias.
Yeah.
Implicit bias. It's fascinating.
Yeah.
Really.
Implicit bias test, Harvard. Yeah, I was trying to find that again, because I was reading an article by a colleague about Yogacara, and he mentioned, I don't know if it was them or a similar one, where people taking this test are flashed very brief images of different figures holding guns or playing cards. And white people are much more likely to misidentify black people holding a playing card as holding a gun, like much more likely, yeah, so that kind of thing. So it's interesting stuff, you know, and of course you don't really know that, it's just, it comes out when you click one button or the other in that particular test. So, individual and collective, yeah, Judith.
Oh, it just popped into my mind, you know, even in our chanting, when we talk about our lineage,
mm-hmm.
We talk about, you know, we don't say our male, you know, our male ancestor is blah, 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 but we talk about our female ancestor, and that's a part of what we're, you know, the assumption is that male is the privilege.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's partly because in a more formal service, which we ended up not doing, you actually say all the names of the ancestors who are all men, from Buddha, you know, down to your own teacher. And what we say about, you know, all the other woman ancestors is kind of a corrective to that. But we don't actually say the list of men, so it's interesting,
yeah.
You know. Yeah, yeah.
But and the ones who said the list of men didn't say anything about women. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, to be straight about it, you would interweave the
yeah.
men and the women together.
Right.
In one list of ancestors. One
right.
Yeah.
Right.
So
yeah.
The Zen Center added the women's list. Yeah.
If it's done, it's done after, yeah.
Yeah.
It's done after.
They have women who they have the male
ancestors.
The male ancestors and the women ancestors.
Yeah, and we'll do that.
It's a sweet chant.
Yeah, we'll do that at Rahatsu and Jeff's lineage out of Minnesota has a very lovely way of singing the woman's ancestors. So don't miss that at Rahatsu Day. So yeah, but it is it's a strange thing to think about, individual and collective consciousness, responsibilities, patterns, tendencies, because it's all there below the surface. And now I'm a little creeped out that the only man in the room is the boss.
We can move.
Uh-oh.
No.
At least we're kind of in a circle. That's good.
We don't do that.
I'm having that kind of oh shit feeling, like uh-oh.
It also sounds yes. to me like he's referencing the Bodhisattva path a little bit.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I see that weaved in.
Yeah, can you say more about how you see that?
Oh, just in the individual and collective that we can't find enlightenment unless everyone else. Just the Bodhisattva path, the Mahayana tradition, and that the idea with that path is that we're not going to become enlightened unless every other being mm-hmm. is as well.
Right.
So you have to acknowledge the collective for full enlightenment. That's what that path is.
Right, that's a nice connection, yes, absolutely. Where were we, seven?
Seven.
No,
six.
Six. Oh boy. The quality of our life depends on the quality of the seeds that lie deep in our consciousness. So this is really actually pretty radical to think about, because we focus on the circumstances, and he's saying it's the seeds. And of course, you know, in actuality it's a dance between the seeds and our circumstances. But a kind of real pure reading of this school, and they varied, you know, the Yogacara had many branches. And the sort of pure, there was sort of a purist branch that said, well, no, actually, it's only your mind. It's only your seeds. That's the whole thing. And I think more useful to us is to have a sense of that we just got out of balance, that we overemphasize circumstances and don't have enough curiosity about what's happening subconsciously. And so let's bring that back into balance, because we're not going to buy it if it's only mind. So we throw it away. So anyway, that's our school, you know.
But you know, unconscious conditioning. That you don't know about.
Yeah, you don't know until it manifests, yeah.
Distort your
absolutely.
Experience.
Absolutely. And that's what we'll get to when we talk more about perception, is the idea that there's what they call transformations, perceptions really, at every level. At every level of this, things get altered. And tomorrow morning probably, we're going to watch a little science video. And that's some fascinating stuff from cognitive neuroscience about perception that says the exact same thing. Anyway, so think about the seeds. Seven, the function of store consciousness is to receive and maintain seeds and their habit energies so they can manifest in the world or may remain dormant. So some of them might be dormant our whole lifetime. It's a vast field, and only a little subset of them, depending on both conditions and the sort of patterns of manas, who's a sort of selector, you know, looking for which of these seeds are most important for my me-ness, you know, my me-ness. And let me make a note about this one. You know, sometimes you make notes for a talk and then you read them later and you're like, what does this mean? I'll just read it to you. The manifestation that we take to be perception is always influenced by the process of alaya vijnana and manas, and how mind consciousness receives the thoughts and perceptions. So whatever we perceive, whatever manifests, is always a dance between all these different consciousnesses. The seeds, the self-centered selector under the covers, and then our conscious mind. But I don't know the point I was trying to make. This is not just about, like, we tend to sort of think about this stuff, our mind goes to like sort of psychological conditioning, and I'm kind of more this way, more that way. The idea of this is that it affects perception and understanding of absolutely everything, including so-called physical external reality. So that depending on, you know, our storehouse and our manas and our, you know, everything, all eight of these, we see chairs differently too. We see mountains differently too. You know, and we see people, of course, differently. So it happens in a real radical way. Everything is transformed by our consciousness. But that some of these habit energies just go dormant and stay dormant, you know. Okay. Verse 8, manifestations from store consciousness can be perceived directly in the mode of things in themselves as representations or as mirror images. All are included in the 18 elements of being. Okay, so now he's getting technical again. Sorry?
No, the 15 elements of being is the new.
Okay, let's see. Where did I put the perception page? No, you're, that's not yet. Hold on. Oh, here we go. We'll get to the 18 first. But so in perception, in this particular Buddhist map of perception, sorry, that's kind of flipped over there. There are three fields of perception, that's what we're talking about here. Three fields of perception. And they're kind of varying degrees of directness. So there's a very direct perception, which he's calling things in themselves. And he explains in the footnotes, he actually took that phrase from Kant. But it maps to the Buddhist concept pretty well, so Kant will do. Well, that must be a translation of Kant, right? What did Kant say in German? So that's the first level, very direct kind of perception. And then there's a field of perception that's representational. And that's where we hang out most of the time. So this is like back to the bell. You know, we're actually seeing a representation of the bell for the most part. We're not really seeing the real bell. But in the level of representation, there's usually still some connection, you know, to sensory perception. But it's mostly happening in our mind, in our mind consciousness. But then the third one is the field of mirror images. This is when we're just making it up, you know. It's just an image in the mind, increasingly disconnected from anything that we're actually perceiving. And of course, the further we get, the idea is that the further we get from, you know, things as they are, the more distorted and confused, and the more trouble we have communicating and relating to each other, because our images and our representations, you know, are different, you know, are different from each other. And if it does turn out there's an objective reality, different from the objective reality. But in addition to that, this gets kind of gnarly. So in addition to there being three fields of increasing degrees of directness, there are three modes. So there's like nine combinations here. So Buddhist love is kind of math, you know? Yeah, combinatorial math is a big Buddhist thing. So there's a direct mode of perception. So the direct mode can go with the field of things in yourself, and then you're just like, you're golden. But then much more often for us is inferential mode of perception. So this is how we operate most of the time, right? We receive a small amount of data, somebody's tone of voice, I don't know, a little fragment of something we think of or hear, and then we infer the rest of it, you know. That's why, you know, meeting somebody the first time, we instantly have a whole theory of what kind of person they are, right? So it's an inferential mode of perception based on a representation. Or maybe they really remind you of your ex-whoever, and then you're actually in the realm of images, you know? Nothing to do with this person. An image of something else is going on. And so in the Yogacara system, we're encouraged to pay more attention to perception itself, perception as a process. And just like the way, you know, the seeds and the manas is sort of occluded, you know, sort of can't really see it, the challenge of perception is we always kind of think we're right? We think we're perceiving what is. And so the encouragement with meditation and practice and so on is to wonder, like, am I perceiving directly? Or am I inferring something, you know? Or am I actually just completely coming to the wrong conclusion? So there's a false mode of perception too. Is my mode a little more direct or a little more inferential or maybe just downright wrong? And what's the sort of environment, you know, sort of internal environment of that perception, field of perception? Very direct, representational, or imagined, you know? Mirror images is kind of imagined. And all of this is useful, so there's nothing wrong with imagining things. But it's kind of like the worlds we make in our mind about the future and the past. This is a useful quality of mind that we can imagine the future, right? That's how we make decisions. That we can rehash the past. That's how we learn. But the trick for us as practitioners is to remember that that's not real, you know? Those are not real. We're making them up in our heads. Is there a real world in the middle? Yeah.
False mirror image.
It's a false mirror, yeah.
What would that be, for example? And kind of like, one, I acknowledge this is imaginary, and then it's false in that. There's no right or wrong in
In an image?
Mirror images.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah, that's a good question.
Yeah, we'll see. This is mirror image, not mirror.
A mirror, yeah, a mirror image, yeah, a mirror image, like only an image, yeah, only, yeah. Thich Nhat Hanh adds that modifier, mirror image, and our other character here. Tagawa Roshi, I think, does just say images, the realm of images or the field of images. So he's going to say more about this. So let's hold some of our confusion as confusion for a minute. And then that's the other piece here, you know, like when seeds of confusion arise, you know, how do we respond? You know, fix them up right away, hang with it for a while. You know? So now we're getting to the rest of the, more about perception. Okay, let's see. I know, I was going to read you a little thing about the way the mind seems to perceive. We'll see how well this matches up. This is a little excerpt from an interesting neuroscience book, kind of lay neuroscience book called Buddha's Brain. So it's a nice book. I have a scientist friend who tells me some, it's not too great, but I think it's a good book. So, in that book they said, how does your brain decide if something should be approached or avoided? So that's a perceptual question, right? Should I approach this or avoid it? This is a guy named Rick Hansen. Let's say you're walking in the woods, you round a bend, and suddenly see a curvy shape on the ground right smack in front of you. To simplify a complex process, during the first few tenths of a second, light bouncing off this curved object is sent to the occipital cortex, which handles visual information, for processing into a meaningful inner image. The occipital cortex then sends representations of this image in two directions. To the hippocampus, which is part of the limbic system, the kind of reptile brain they call it, to the hippocampus for evaluation as a potential threat or opportunity, and to the prefrontal cortex, kind of higher reasoning, and other parts of the brain for more sophisticated and time-consuming analysis. Just in case, your hippocampus immediately compares the image to a short list of danger shapes. Jump first, think later, dangers. And quickly finds that curvy shapes are on the danger list, causing it to send a high priority alert to your amygdala. Watch out! The amygdala, which is like an alarm bell, then pulses both a general warning throughout your brain and a special fast-track signal to your fight-or-flight neural and hormonal systems. And later on he explains the details of fight-or-flight. The point here is that a second or so after you spot a curving shape, you jump back in alarm. Meanwhile, this powerful but relatively slow prefrontal cortex has been pulling information out of long-term memory to figure out whether this darn thing is a snake or a stick. As a few more seconds go by, the prefrontal cortex zeroes in on a few things. First, the object's inert nature doesn't appear to be moving, and the fact that several people ahead of you just walk by without saying anything, and concludes that it's only a stick. So that's an interesting little kind of neural map of perception. And so here, and it was more than one perception that happened, right? You know, there's a very fast perception, you know, I don't exactly totally understand how to map that to this, but there was a very fast perception, which actually turned out to be essentially false, but having qualities of accuracy, right? It was a curvy shape, you know. And then some inferential work went on, and maybe that's kind of a direct perception in the end, like, oh, I see it now, it's a stick, you know. So, you know, where do we go all this, and, you know, do we need to learn a lot about science or Buddhist models of perception? I don't know, but I think all of it just kind of adds to this idea of there being these mysterious influences and habit energies that we can't feel, to recognize also that there's complicated stuff going whenever we perceive anything. And whether it's, you know, any kind of perception, right? What somebody tells us, what we see, what we hear, right? That there's lots of processing going that may result in us, you know, either making some kind of more direct contact with things, more or less as they are, or more inferential, or more distorted, or just downright wrong, right? So I think it's mostly an encouragement to kind of think again, you know, pay attention. And so perception is really woven into these teachings. Any thoughts there? Mm-hmm.
Question. If something is not perceived by anyone, mm-hmm. Has anything happened?
Doesn't, you know, when a tree falls in the forest, yeah.
Kind of that.
I always felt like,
I understand you perceive something differently than I do and something differently from someone else does, but beyond those, there is what happened.
Well, that's a kind of, you know, a big question of, you know, ontology, right? You know, do things happen if we don't perceive them? And I think that our Western frame is, yeah, of course, there's an objective reality. We just happen to be subjective beings in the middle of that. But I think the people in the Yogacara school would say, well, they either say no or we don't know, I think, you know. I don't think they would be ever so sure that there's an objective reality outside of what consciousness is. Yeah, I think they would say, I think the best answer is we don't know. And how could we? I mean, how could we really know, right? And we've all agreed that there is, but does that make it true, you know? Yeah, right. Like they have the idea of consensus reality, right? You know, it's kind of overlap, you know.
Mm-hmm. And does this only speak of humans or beings, which is a different question?
I'm sorry, say it again. Humans or beings? Do beings?
It's
well, we
like
can't talk to the other beings, so we don't know.
If someone, you know, if nobody sees it, but maybe there are beings that do not have eyes and don't hear, and yet.
It falls on them.
Yeah. It falls on them, or like the last bat dies and the whole forest dies.
Right.
Because nobody can fertilize the flowers anymore. So
right.
We tend to get a little human centric.
Right, right. That's a very good point, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so it's all bigger than we can know, right? Okay, let's do a few more verses, then I want to do a little writing. Okay.
Well, I was thinking along the lines of Connie, but number one under fields, things in themselves, just the expression in itself, to me, was making an assumption that there is an objective reality out there. And so that, are they starting?
What is the thing that you're in contact with? Yeah,
direct. Kind of says the same thing.
That
was used as one of the arguments for the existence of God, I think, by some of the philosophers.
Really?
Yeah. That it can exist when you close your eyes because it's in God's eye.
The other thing that's interesting about all this is that that these consciousnesses come and go. Somehow this will connect what you said, I think, but we'll see. That only when you're seeing does the eye consciousness arise. You know, you aren't seeing anything, close your eyes, there's little or no eye consciousness. You can still see into your eyelids, I guess. And all the senses are that way. But then the mind is seen as the same way. The mind only exists, the mind consciousness only exists when it's in action. And since it's in action almost all the time, it kind of fools us into thinking that it's sort of permanent and continuous. And the examples that they usually give are like deep sleep or being in a coma. But also in meditation, you sometimes can notice or at least infer, because you weren't there at the time, that there was a gap, you know, that the mind consciousness stopped. And that's one of their arguments for why the sixth consciousness isn't quite a complete model for why we have this sense of continuity. Whereas the Alaya Vijnana, with its buddhi manas going up and down, up and down, up and down, even though it's not permanent, it's continuously functioning. It's always going on. Seeds are sprouting and being planted and influencing each other constantly. So it's like, it's actually the constant. So the thing that's really constant is below our level of awareness. So anyway, that's kind of interesting too. Okay.
I think that we're permanently in a state of confusion. And that we should just accept that and then we'll be happy.
Okay. That sounds good. Okay, verse 9. So there's a lot to this, obviously, right? More than we're going to figure out one weekend. All manifestations bear the marks of both the individual and collection and collective, the collective. The maturation of store consciousness functions in the same way, in its participation in the different stages and realms of being. So, not sure if we need to say much more there. Here's collective and individual again. Everything folding itself together. 10. Unobstructed and indeterminate, store consciousness is continuously flowing and changing. That's what it said. At the same time, it is endowed with all five universal mental formations. So this actually turns out to be seen as a really important point. It seems like nothing to us, but let's hear what our teachers say. So unobstructed means it functions freely according to what's in it and what conditions come to it. And indeterminate means it's neither wholesome nor unwholesome. So like Chris was pointing out this morning, there's absolutely no original sin here. And Takagawa Sensei writes, this aspect of the Alaya Vijnana being intrinsically, having an intrinsically indeterminate moral quality is vitally important. You getting excited? Vitally important. From a religious or practice perspective. Although we humans are greatly influenced by our past, we are at the same time endowed with the potential to create an entirely different future, starting right here and now. No matter how deeply our past is filled with evil karma. But on the other hand, even if our days were filled with efforts toward cultivating Buddhahood, we can never assume we have safely achieved a level of perfection. The past cannot be altered or brushed off by excuses. We are nothing but a vast, unerring receptacle of our past, even things we've consciously forgotten. It is our past in totality that is the basis of our being, and yet we can align ourselves with Buddhist teaching with a view towards tomorrow. This is the beginning of a life based on the wisdom of Yogacara. The possibility for this lies in the fact that the Alaya Vijnana is ever ripening and indeterminate. Get all that? So it's like, on the one hand, oh man, it's like good news, bad news here. On the one hand, bad news, vast and endless, could be filled with infinite numbers of difficult seeds. You know, what are we going to do? On the other hand, nothing inherently good or bad about the whole system. It's a process, right? It's you know, it's like karma, cause and effect. And so as we become more skillful in how we practice with it, you know, little by little, you know, we respond skillfully when unwholesome seeds arise. We manage to, plant and support and nourish wholesome seeds, and gradually we learn how to live in such a way and create conditions such that unwholesome seeds arise less. And those are the three things that we're told to work on. It's like a three-step process. And, you know, actually doing this is a little more complicated, but the first is, practice in such a way that fewer unwholesome seeds arise. The second is, when unwholesome seeds arise, work with them skillfully. And the third is to nurture wholesome seeds, you know, keep them going and planted and nurtured. So this turns out to be really good news that this has these sort of morally neutral qualities. At least that's how they thought about it in the 4th century. So I'm going to push on a little bit longer, and then we're going to do something else. And yeah, do feel free to change posture or get up or whatever you need. Is that 10 or 11? 10. 11. Although impermanent without a separate self, store consciousness contains all phenomena in the cosmos, both conditioned and unconditioned in the form of seeds. So conditioned and unconditioned is a big deal in Buddhist epistemology. We tend to think of kind of form and matter, and here it's conditioned and unconditioned. So most everything is conditioned. The 51 things are conditioned. But unconditioned is nirvana and freedom. So the potential, what that's saying is, in addition to all the sort of good and bad that's in here, there are seeds that are beyond good and bad, seeds that are just pure freedom and liberation. So it's all in there. And the last point is, how does all this work with the seeds? But let's get to that later. Okay, let's take a 2-minute stretch break. And while we're stretching and breaking, let's make sure we have something to write with and on. And I have some extra notebooks here. So we have some extra pens.
There are pens outside, and I bought a bunch recently.
Oh, I need one. Oh, that's a nice one. A decomposition book. Anyone else in the pen? One of the seeds that keeps ripening me is like, why does it take so long to go through this stuff? I thought we were going to be like way further already. All right. So when you're ready, get comfortable. We're going to do a little writing.
I
one has a bunch of notes in it. It says in here, to study the self is to forget the self.
You've already done your assignment. Oh.
Okay, so I want to do a little experiment in continuous writing. This is kind of like a Natalie Goldberg, you know, type exercise, if you know her, where I give us a sentence starter, you know, on a topic, and for X amount of minutes till I ring the bell, we just try to keep the hand moving and just keep writing. And the idea is to completely not worry about whether you're saying the writing the right things or the wrong things. You're trying to bring that sort of consciousness offline and just let stuff flow out of your pen, and then to keep writing, you can just write like, I don't know what to write next. This is really boring. When are we? Oh, then there's this, and you know, just to keep yourself writing. So let's see. Let me wait for Connie to come back before we start this first one. Formations is it's close experiences, close enough to experiences. Yeah, it's kind of a technical term for the way the mind assembles things, but it's close enough to experiences. Yeah, I was going to get to seeds and how they're produced and maintained in a little bit. But. Can I just go to the bathroom or something? Mm-hmm. Oh. Well, I think I'm going to, let's go ahead and start. Okay, so the first topic is really straightforward. It's you. So, I am. That's a sentence starter. I am. So when you're ready, just write I am and keep going. You can go back to I am. You can make a list. You can make an essay. You can make a bullet list, whatever. I am. Please just start writing and don't stop. Just don't stop. I am. What are you? Come over here, I'll tell you what we're doing. You're doing one of those things where you just write continuously, you know, and just kind of keep your pen moving. And the starter sentence is, I am. That's
okay.
It. I am. What are you? You know, just I am. Just keep the pen moving.
I'm sorry I had to step out.
No, it's okay.
Too well.
Yeah, no, the body needs what it needs. Keep going. a little bit longer. Finishing that thought. Huh. Find out anything? Wow.
Interesting.
The next step is to read back through this and pick out like something like more, you know, 5 to 8 or maybe 5 to 10 of the most important words and phrases. What just jumps out in you as you reread it? What are the most important things? And circle those. We reread and circle somewhere like 5 to 10, maybe, whatever, what words and phrases seem most important or most true or most something. Circle those. Okay, everyone done that? Okay, next, maybe you remember, I may have done this with you before, so hopefully this won't be a shock. So now you've got great material for the poem of who you are. So setting aside the inner critic completely, she's got seeds going, but setting aside the inner critic or recognizing her seeds if they sprout, write a little poem using as many of those words and phrases as you sort of comfortably can. Maybe the title of the poem is I Am, I don't know, but this is a little poem of who you are, at least who you seem to be at the moment.
Just using the words?
You can add connector words and phrases, but try to feature the words and phrases that you circled in a little bit of verse, doggerel, you know, free verse, limerick or a sonnet would be okay. Let's write a poem. Just see what comes out. And you can repeat stuff or add words or whatever you want to do. Okay, so maybe another minute on that. All right, now we're going to start again, start over again. The new, a different topic for our free writing. Same thing, just keeping the pen going. I could be. Let's see what comes out. I could be. So here it's just like letting the pen tell us, you know. I could be. Let's try that. Just keep writing. Or maybe just, I could, you know, that might be better. Okay, just a little longer. Okay, same process. 5 or 10 words or phrases that jump out at you is somehow most significant. And let's see if we can throw them into a whole different poem. Poem of whatever, possibility or something. Or recognition, I don't know.
Start the
poem? Mm-hmm, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, sure. Thank you. Okay, another minute or two. That at least for now, it's all provisional anyway. And then I thought we would get ourselves into some groups of three and just compare notes about what we notice in this process. We kind of just exercise this system in a certain way, right? So you don't have to share anything too close, and surely you don't have to read your little poem unless you would like to. But I'm mostly curious about process. What did you notice, you know, as we directed the conscious mind to bring up this thought of what I am or what I could be? Just what happened for you? What happened in the mind, in the heart? What was the feeling of that? Anything interesting or surprising come out of the pen? You know, that there's some way that you can bring up. Does that make sense? So why don't we all stand up? Because you don't have to necessarily be with the people right next to you. And find a couple partners. I think with me included, we divide by three quite handily. And no particular structure, just to have a conversation.